and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us on Alaska Public Media as we travel to different spots throughout our community and listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans.
This week, we're featuring Common Sense, Stories of Alaska's Changing Economy, a storytelling event in the style of Arctic entries. This event took place September 29th at 49th State Brewing Company and was hosted by Alaska Common Ground. Today we're featuring a shortened version of all the stories that were given. If you'd like to hear the full-length show, please visit alaskapublic.org.
So our first storyteller for tonight is what I would call the biggest fan of Alaska. He's such a big fan, he can barely ever leave. But when he does, and he has, he usually does it to do stand-up comedy. So you might hear a joke or two. But Cliff Groh has been not only is a member board of directors of Alaska Common Grounds, but is also on the executive committee. And he has been involved with Alaska politics and Alaska economy for more years than I've been in Alaska. So our first storyteller, Cliff Groh.
In January of 1982, I was 27 years old, and I felt that I had something to prove. I had graduated from college and returned to my native Anchorage, and I had gone to work at an alternative newspaper where I'd enjoyed a lot, worked very hard, tried to make it succeed, but it failed. And then I tried writing on my own. Did not exactly set the world on fire as a freelance writer. I then, at the beginning of 1981, I started work at the Alaska Legislature. I worked there for a year, liked it a lot, thought that I had learned a great deal, but I hadn't exactly racked up a lot of achievements in a very unusual time. So in January of 1982, at the beginning of that session, I created a new job for myself, the most unusual job I've ever had, probably one of the unique ones of the world. I made myself the principal legislative assistant on the Alaska Permanent Fund Dividend legislation that created the Alaska Permanent Fund Dividend we have today. That was an amazing thing in all kinds of levels. That legislation was radical, controversial, and complex. Radical in the sense that what you were talking about doing was paying Alaskans, each eligible Alaskan who applied, an equal amount of money each year that the state would send without any regard to a means test or what people made or did not make. This was in contrast to the original bill that was hung up in litigation at that time, the original plan, which I call, this is the Cliff Groh name, nobody else called it that, the longer you hear, the more you get, which was the one where the longer you had lived in Alaska, like I had an original, a resident who had been born in the territory, I would have gotten way more money than people who had only been here two or three years. But I recognized that that plan wasn't gonna survive constitutional scrutiny in the courts. So I worked on this other plan, and I had not thought of it. There, I would credit three men who were, in particular, who are no longer with us today, Governor Jay Hammond, Representative Hugh Malone, and Jim Rode, a longtime legislative assistant and special assistant to the trustee of the Permanent Fund. But there was nobody more responsible on a day-to-day level and immersed in it than in 1982 to make that legislation happen for the Equal Payments Plan than myself. I said controversial. When we had our first meeting the first week of the legislative session with a small core group of legislators, one of them said, "Do we have votes outside this room?" And the highest estimate we could come at the beginning of the session of the number of legislators who would vote for it was 10. That was insufficient because there are 60 legislators. So that started out with a very small group of people. It was a tripartisan group. It's sort of hard to describe. There were Democrats, Republicans, and even Libertarians, because there were two Libertarians in the legislature then. So a small, hearty group, but let's emphasize that word small. So like I said, a controversial bill, because the very idea of obviously distributing money was very strange and unusual for people to get their minds around, particularly when it was it was no longer tied to the idea of long-time residency of the state. And also complex. Ladies and gentlemen, this was very tricky, because not only did you have sort of the basic philosophical questions of, is this a good idea, you had to work with a lot of people on, but also, how do you handle minors? Do you pay them, do you hold the money for them until they turn 18? Or, as eventually the legislation decided, you have immediate distribution to them through parents and guardians. How do you handle public assistance? Because whole question is very tricky, that you don't want to have people be paid permanent fund dividends and be net losers because they lose more money from their public assistance payment than they would get in the dividend. And that was a really little live possibility until the work was done to make that not be true. And then also, of course, there's the very basic question of residency. If you're not going to have long cumulative residency back to statehood and classes like that, you have to figure out how short or long you make the required residency period. This is the year before I went to law school, but I came up with a very conservative argument that we had to go with 6 months, and I sold the legislature on this. The other sort of very tricky part about it was, how do you tie this backstop plan, the plan that would only go into effect if the United States Supreme Court struck down the original legislation, which I thought was likely to occur, but how do you make that happen in terms of the contingencies? So the result of it was a very complicated bill that I was sometimes accused that I was the only person to understand, understood, because it had all kinds of contingencies and trigger dates. One journalist in particular bitterly complained to me. He says, no one can understand this, Cliff. And I said, well, it is sort of hard. You have to walk through very carefully. I color-coded my version of it with magic markers because there were so many overlapping and trigger dates and different provisions kicking with different outcomes. And with all this responsibility did not exactly come with great pay. As a matter of fact, I was paid less than the janitors. Showing the typical financial personal acumen I've always shown in my life, at the beginning of the session, I went into my boss, a man 3.5 years older than me, and I said, you know, Terry, there's been sort of a difficult situation here in terms of some political reverses for our side. I'll try to make it easier. I'll take half pay this session. He accepted this. And then this became even funnier when the local newspaper, the Juneau Empire, printed all of the legislative salaries in the newspaper. And there it was at the bottom, below the janitors. So the legislative lawyer, remember this is the year before I went to law school, the legislative lawyer, the drafter who wrote it said, I was working with him, and Jim said, hey Cliff, we gotta slip a commission in for you. I said, you know, Jim, I appreciate the sentiment, but thanks anyway. The even funnier moment came when another legislative staff member I was working with had seen the paper and saw that I was paid less than the janitors and said, Cliff, this is sort of surprising. And I said, you know, I do this for free. She said, no, don't let anybody hear you. I know you're surprised, ladies and gentlemen, to find out that she went to law school too and became an Anchorage lawyer, made a lot more money than I ever did with that good attitude that she had about that. But as I told her, I would have done it for free, because I love the work, and it brought out my best self. And it was very complicated work in terms of the research, the writing, the legal analysis, the political strategy, the vote counting, the lobbying, and the sort of out-of-the-box maneuvers to think about how to move this legislation forward. And if my professional life was pretty odd then, my personal life was fairly strange too, because I lived in a very unusual place. Housing was very expensive back then in Juneau. Rents were high, and it was very difficult to get housing. So I ended up living on a very steep mountainside in Juneau on the third, above the third floor of a house built on a small ledge up a steep hillside. It took more than 100 steps from the street to go up to the ground floor where there were two bedrooms It was built by an artist, very much, and it was the bedroom was occupied by her and her former boyfriend, who lived in the bottom on the ground floor. Then you walked up another steep set of stairs to the second floor, and then another even steeper set of stairs to the third floor, and then you climbed hand over hand on a built-in ladder nailed into the wall to get to a bed above the third floor, and that's where I lived. And the stairs had no doors. So the person in the living room or the kitchen could hear me up in my bed and I could hear them. It was this amazing situation. This was sort of hard in particular because I worked so hard and I had such a terrible diet. I would describe my diet at that point. I would tell people, I live on citrus and amphetamine. And I want to hasten to say, that wasn't really true. That meant oranges and no-dose pills. Because I didn't like the taste of coffee, so I would gobble these caffeine supplements to keep going. And that was a lot of what my diet was. And between the lack of sleep with this intense job and the hours I imposed on myself and this diet, it's not the best for my health. As a matter of fact, I developed a persistent cough, so bad that my landlady could hear it down, remember, you could hear all the way down from my bed down to the living room and the kitchen. So I was so bad and so persistent, she made me even go to the doctor because I coughed so badly. But I kept going and kept pushing on through, and through a combination of carrots and sticks and various maneuvers, we made the bill move along. And there was no legislative session limit then. The session ran almost 6 months, from January all the way into June. And then on a day in early June, actually it was a night, the State House of Representatives passed the bill at 5:15 a.m. after a marathon all-night session. And I ran home, ran up the stairs and to the ground floor, and burst into the bedroom of my sleeping artist, landlady, and friend, and I woke her up by bouncing on the bed. She was very, very surprised. When I woke her up and I said, Phyllis, the House passed the bill. And then a few days later, the state Senate passed the bill, and then the governor signed it. And since then, the people of Alaska have received more than $21 billion in Alaska Permanent Fund dividends since then.
Cliff followed all of his instructions on storytelling, except for one. He was supposed to end it with, "You're welcome." Thank you, Cliff. Our next storyteller grew up here in Alaska, in Fairbanks, and is going to tell us a story about how she made her way back. Please put your hands together for Moira Sullivan.
I always knew that I would come back to Alaska. After 13 years of being away, living in Boston, Minneapolis, Ireland, and Washington, D.C., I finally set a date in the spring of 2015. I said that I would be back living in the last frontier by December 31st of that year. Sure, oil prices had hit rock bottom, and the legislature was refusing to act. Some layoffs had started to hit Anchorage, but I was born and raised here, as were my parents, my grandparents, and my great-grandparents. Alaska's in my blood, and I knew that I had to come home. I had tried to come home once before. Immediately after graduating college, I came back, and I thought that I would start my professional life up here. I didn't exactly know what I wanted to do, and my European history degree didn't help me narrow it down very much. So I thought I would apply for some professional entry-level jobs. I applied for 27 jobs in marketing, politics, finance, consulting, you name it. None of them asked me to interview. Without fail, every single company said, "While we're very impressed with your academic background, we simply don't consider candidates without prior professional experience for entry-level jobs." So after months of this kind of rejection, I actually was offered a job at a prestigious consulting firm in Boston, and I accepted. I grudgingly packed my bags and I moved out east. But every year I swore that I would come back to Alaska. And each month I was checking job listings in Anchorage, looking for that perfect job and that opportunity to come home. Which is why in the spring of 2015, I finally decided that the time had come and I set my date and I set my course and I would be home by the end of that year. Meanwhile, I was a young woman in her 20s, living in the big city, meeting people, going on dates, mostly terrible, and having generally a great time. And then something impossible happened. In June of that year, I fell in love. It was Bloom's Day, a day that is considered a holiday by Irish people around the world and fans of James Joyce, because it is the day on which the entirety of the book Ulysses takes place. I got a text message the day before asking if I would like to grab a drink to celebrate. And it was from an unlikely source. A man who I had become acquainted with about a year before through his online dating profile. We had exchanged some witty and flirtatious messages and in fact agreed to go on a date. 8 minutes before the prearranged time we were supposed to meet, I blew him off and never rescheduled. And several months later, we randomly ran into each other on a DC Metro platform. For several minutes, we awkwardly struggled to figure out where we recognized each other from, until we realized that it was from our online dating profile pictures. And then we awkwardly went our separate ways. And many months after that, we actually did reconnect, and we went on a date. Three, as a matter of fact. Each progressively worse than the last. So by February, I had written him off. But when this text message came in June, I thought, sure, what the heck, I will go and have one friendly drink with this guy. What harm could it possibly do? It turned into one of those nights that you think only happens in movies or Victorian romance novels. We met, we drank Guinness, we talked, we had Irish stew, we drank more Guinness, we talked, until the band became so loud that we couldn't hear each other anymore. And then he offered to walk me home about an hour from the bar, and we talked the whole way. When we got to my apartment building, he said, you know, I wasn't planning on saying anything like this to you tonight, but I'm going to be dead someday, and I don't want to regret not telling you. You're the most charming person I've ever met in my life, and I would really like to go out with you again. That was, of course, my last first date. The man of my dreams is from New York and was living in Washington, D.C., working in a job he loved with absolutely no aspirations or intentions of living anywhere else for the foreseeable future. I, on the other hand, had set my watch and decided that on December 31st, I would be here living in Anchorage, Alaska. And it seemed as though those two were on a collision course. My first love, Alaska, or the love of my life, Greg. And so began the conversation of trying to convince my future husband that despite the economic challenges and headwinds that Alaska faced, this, right now, this was the exact time to move there, to be a part of it, and to invest in the place that is Alaska. So here's what I told him. Alaska is not a place where people get second chances. Alaska is a place where you get 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th chances, and people still forgive you and let you start again from scratch. Alaska is a place where, for better or worse, there isn't a real structure to things. You can't come up here and have some sort of predetermined career path. You come up here and you make your own career path. You write your own story. And if you have no idea what that career path should look like, then all the better, because you'll probably end up doing something that's never been done before. For example, in 1946, my mother's parents came to Anchorage on their honeymoon immediately after my grandfather was discharged from the Pacific Theater in World War II. They loved it so much that they decided to stay. They spent the summer of 1946 building a log cabin by hand in Mountain View. My grandmother spent her days, 5 months pregnant, skinning logs for their cabin. And my grandfather worked for the Northern Commercial Company. He sold Kaiser Frazier cars, and then he worked for Buick. Later in 1952, he started his own auto dealership, Northwest Auto Sales, at 5th and Gamble, and he was the first person in the state of Alaska to sell Jeeps. Then, in the grand tradition of Irishmen everywhere and at every point in history, living very far away from where he was from in a foreign land, he decided to run for office. He was elected to the first Alaska state legislature after statehood. He wrote his own story. Alaska is full of people who are earnest and sincere, and I have a couple of theories about that. First, this is a place where, how shall I say, we're a bit geographically isolated. Personally, I like that. I have a feeling most of you in this room probably do too, or you wouldn't be here. But being geographically isolated means if we don't have something that you want here, you're gonna have to make it yourself, because you don't have the option to just drive one town over for great opera or Italian food. You have to find a way to get it right here, or you're simply not gonna have it. That's why we have a phenomenal performing arts center, cultural assets that make us the envy of many cities three times our size in the lower 48. It's why we have the best pizza in the world, the best ice cream, and definitely the best beer. We didn't have it, and so we made it. And the second reason is because Alaska is a place where you can actually make a difference with your hard work. Now, in many places in America right now, people are dying of apathy. They are disconnected and disaffected. They feel like the world is too big and they are too small. They feel like the political system is too corrupt and there's nothing that they can do about it. But it's not so here. Here, if you actually want to change things, you roll up your sleeves, you go to a half a dozen community council meetings, maybe a couple of Rotary lunches, you meet with your assembly members and members of the legislature because you probably are on a first name basis with them, and you can actually affect real change in 18 months. Boom, done. I mean, I'm not saying that anything can happen here, except, yeah, no, I am. Anything can happen here. So Alaska is this really incredible place. And why do I believe that right now is the best time to be in Alaska? Because why wouldn't I want to be here as we face our biggest challenges? Alaska is a place where people aren't afraid of doing hard work when hard work needs to be done. It's where we don't believe that the future has been predetermined or written for us. We will write that story ourselves. And it is a place where we still actually believe in that old adage, we don't all have to get along, but we do all have to survive the winter. So I guess that argument was pretty persuasive, or at least my passion and my zeal for moving home and making Alaska the number one place to live, work, and play must have been fairly convincing, because he put a ring on it, and my fiancé moved here in May and got a job, and we're here for the long haul.
You won't be surprised that Maura is now the director of Live, Work, Play here in Anchorage, because she does it like, she's the biggest advocate I've ever met. Cliff and I had a joke that he's the biggest pessimist in Alaska and I'm the biggest optimist, and I found someone who's like 10 times more optimistic than I am. Our next speaker, Cal, came to Alaska in the 1960s because his grandma told him he had to. Well, sort of. So let's welcome Cal to tell his story.
Thank you very much. That is kind of true. She did. What happened was, I was born. And somebody mistook that. They thought the Messiah had been born, and 7 days later, they bombed Pearl Harbor. 7 days after I was born, they bombed Pearl Harbor. My father and a great number of the men his age disappeared for 4 years. During that period of time, the women, strong women, my grandmother, one of them, and my mother went off to the compress, working in a place where they would process cotton. Other women worked in factories, building machineries for the war effort. The men, as I say, most of them disappeared. It was a segregated South, Monroe, Louisiana. I was lucky, or blessed, if you will, to live with this grandmother who happened to live across the street from a Catholic school. And though she was a Methodist, very active in the Methodist Church, because of the proximity, and she could stand on the back porch and watch what those penguins were doing, she entrusted me with them. There they were, nuns, white women, and priests, white men, across the street in this segregated neighborhood, daring to teach colored children. They thought that colored children could learn just about as much as white children. They had that desire to do this. They had come down from St. Louis, and they talked kind of funny. And as a result, all of the little colored children who went to that school talked kind of funny as well. So whenever we went downtown, people knew that we went to Little Flower Academy just by our articulation. We were different. We were told that we were somebody, and we had to live up to that. We were told to never look up or suck up to anybody, and you dare never look down on anybody. These Franciscans had taken the vow of poverty and service, and they thought the greatest thing that you could do was do good and die broke. Hard pill to swallow. I did well with the first. I'm trying to work on the latter. Then a friend of mine who went to that same academy with a different orientation, his father had lived up here in Alaska for some time and had come back to Monroe, Louisiana with all these nugget watches and rings and stuff. And he talked as if rocks and gold was just all on the streets of Anchorage, Alaska. And all you had to do was come on up there and just pick up a little bit of it. I wanted to get in on that action, so I thought about it, but I was at that time attending Grambling University. Hey, it's called college then. We hadn't reached university status, but we had a football team. Well, the civil rights movement came into Monroe, Louisiana, and I got involved with that. Some guy named Michael Lesser from New York City came in and told us that this status quo that we had grown so accustomed to was not really what we should be involved with, and that we should advocate, agitate, make change. Taught us to be nonviolent. Taught us to accept name-calling and spit in the face and all that stuff. This was kind of tough because at the time I had been trained Strategic Air Command to be a killer because this Vietnam War was on and I had joined up with that. But coming back into my hometown and running to these core people, they seemed to be having more fun. And I got involved, learned to be nonviolent, went out on the picket line, did a few things, and integrated Northeast Louisiana State College. Then these buddies of mine came down from Anchorage for Christmas, 1964. My grandmother overheard the conversation of my buddy and I on the back porch talking about the jobs and the opportunity. She heard that and said, "Yeah, boy, it sounds pretty good up there. You need to go up there." I thought she was really concerned about my economics, but what she was concerned most about was that she thought I was on the lynch list. And she wanted me to get me out of town for the safety. Well, I came to Anchorage, Alaska, and I did find indeed job opportunity was here and available. Charles, who worked over at Providence Hospital, convinced Mrs. Johnson, the dietitian there, that I should be in charge of pots and pans. So I was the director of pots and pans for, oh, probably about 3 or 4 months. Until I heard and learned that over next building over, Alaska Psychiatric Institute was paying $308 a month. That was $8 more than I was making, plus they had benefits. So I went over there, and by the luck of the draw, ended up in Tier 1 retirement. We'll talk about that later. Economics. Sometimes just happen when you're not planning, it just leaps on you. Things happen around you and there you are. I've often said, we don't make the events, we react to them. They come about and we either shrink or we step up to the plate. I've seen this revolving economics here in Anchorage, Alaska. In 1965, there was an area, it still exists, just across from Cal Worthington, down on Ingrave, you're coming into town. Off to the east there, to the right, is an area where Shiloh Church is. It's very low land. You go swooping down in there. Well, that was below the water table. There were a number of people living in there, colored people. They owned all of that land. They owned those houses, but they didn't have running water. It was unimproved land. Our mayor at the time, George M. Sullivan, heard about urban renewal. This was some money given by HUD. If you could define or find within your area a blighted area, you could get money to improve that. And he identified that as the area. We'll take this money, go in and improve it, and we will give those people the first right of refusal. Buy that land and come back. Well, it took so long for this process to go about that the money that they gave the people was either spent, the people either died or moved away, and at the end of all of that process, we ended up with an overabundance of rentals down in that same area. That area, when I arrived here, was economics. They had the Big Hut, the Red X, the Metropolitan Show Lounge. These were clubs owned by African Americans. We had nighttime integration there. Oh, Sheffield came through there. Nick Begich came through there. Oh, those were the days. They had jazz music. People could come down there and have a great old time until 5 o'clock in the morning when everybody went back to their status quo. At the corner of 9th and Carlock there, another economic opportunity came about. There was the S&S apartments that people had been living in since 1941 when those buildings were built for the war effort. Then they had gone into private ownership and they had gone into rental and they had gone into deterioration, and we fought to get them torn down. In the process, we found that there was asbestos there, which created another opportunity. Because we had an opportunity then for the young people to learn asbestos removal and demolition. That was an economic opportunity came about. But over and over, I have seen coming through those areas, economics that go through the community and not to the community. Example, Clark School in Mountain View sat there for the longest of time. When it leaked, and it was about to fall down, we decided to rebuild it. When we rebuilt it, the laborers came from outside the community and made millions of dollars and moved out of the community every evening at 5 o'clock. Same thing happened with the library when it was improved. The workers came from the outside. And when we did the overpass at the Glen Highway, the workers came from the outside. So, not to preach so much, but to say, we live in the most diverse community, and I've seen it. This is my story. I have seen it repeatedly, that we live in the most diverse community, and we say that we are most welcoming, and socially we are having a great time, but economically we are going to have to link up, provide opportunity for all, because if not, that diversity that we are so proud of is going to turn on itself, and it's going to lead to a competitive state that we don't want to face. We are going to have to make opportunity for all, just like we did for Cal Williams when he came in here, make people feel welcomed as Cal Williams when he came in here. Having been here 51 years, I think I have gained the right to love this place while at the same time pointing out the critical issues that we need to deal with. And don't kill the messenger. Work with the message. Let's get it together. Love, peace, and harmony to all. Thanks for listening to my story. I hope indeed I have not been too terribly threatening. God bless you.
You're tuned in to KSKA Anchorage, Alaska Public Media. We're listening to Common Sense, Stories of Alaska's Changing Economy. This storytelling event was hosted by Alaska Common Ground on September 29th. These are true stories related to Alaska's economy, past, present, and possibly the future.
Our next storyteller is my co-host, and I just, you guys should just please give a warm round of applause to John Percy.
After driving up the Alcan for 5 days with my mother, where I'd seen more animals than I'd seen people, We were sitting at Fast Eddie's in Tok, Alaska. The very first thing I ever saw in Alaska. I turned to my mother after seeing some offensive bumper stickers about our current president and said, Mom, I don't think I can do this. Can we turn around and go home? It had all started about 9 months before then. I was at law school at the University of Michigan. I had decided that I wasn't going to go back to a job at a big law firm in Los Angeles, and that instead I wanted to do what I wanted to do from the very, very beginning, which was be the next Atticus Finch, a lawyer who was going to do right by people, who's going to make the world a better place. You'll learn very quickly that that is not how legal practice actually functions, but you can buy me a beer and I'll answer two questions about that later. And I decided I wanted to do a clerkship, which is a one-year gig where you work for a judge or a justice, and you get to help them write opinions. So you get to learn a lot about how the law actually functions. Well, we were lucky enough that we had justices from the Alaska Supreme Court who were coming to Michigan to interview. And it's one of those strange things because oftentimes state Supreme Courts aren't always looking at the most prestigious schools for their clerks, but Alaska, ironically, has that great power, and most of the law clerks who come up here come from schools like Harvard or Yale or Stanford or Berkeley or Michigan. And so, yeah, I know, I'm going to include myself on that list. Or UC Davis. So I was there, and I had my opportunity to do an interview for then-Justice Morgan Christen. And the interview went really well. We had a great time. The connection was really great. I was impressed with her. She was impressed with me. So at the end of the interview, she said, John, I know that a lot of places will give you an offer, and the offer will be make a decision within the next hour. We don't do that in Alaska. We do this kind of draft system, and it takes about 2 weeks for us to be able to hire our law clerks. So if you get another job, please don't take it. I really want you to be my law clerk. So I said, okay, there's a little problem here. I've never been to Alaska. Never even thought about visiting there. I did this interview because I was told that it would be a cool place to work and that the law was really new and you'd get to write a lot of interesting things. But I can live anywhere for a year. Morgan, in her wisdom, turned to me and said, well, John, you're going to come up and you're going to be my law clerk and I'm going to keep you there. This led to a very awkward conversation with Lindsay, my significant other, because I was like, hey, Lindsay, so you know how I've been in Michigan for the last 3 years and you've been in Arizona? How does Alaska sound? She said, well, okay, I guess 1 year in Alaska, we could do 1 year. I could do 1 year. I could live somewhere else for another year. I said, all right, well, we're going to move to Anchorage. So we packed our things up, and I drove up the Alcan, made it to Tok, and said, no, thank you. But I decided to drive on and made it to Anchorage. And when I got to Anchorage, it was May 21st. And it was raining, and it did not stop raining for another 3 weeks, because that's how summers were then, 6 years ago. Not so much anymore. And I was working for the Federal Public Defender's Office and just had a great experience. The lawyers there were terrific and learned a tremendous amount. And by the time I started working for Morgan, I started to really like a lot of things about Anchorage, but was still not convinced. In fact, Lindsay and I were talking about how we were ready to move back and where we would go next. Lindsay had started a blog called My Year in Alaska, because it would only be 1 year. My clerkship started in September, and by November, Morgan came in and said, John, I need to talk to you about something. And I was like, oh gosh, what did I do wrong? Lindsay, it's going to be less than a year. I'm going to get fired. Then we're leaving. But she said, John, I've got an interview for you with the Attorney General, John Burns. And I said, I wasn't expecting that. And she said, well, he's looking for a special assistant. He's willing to wait to hire someone if it's the right person. And I said, okay. Another awkward phone call to Lindsay. Lindsay, I've got this interview with the Attorney General, and my current boss has given me this interview. I can't really say no. And special assistant is kind of one of those jobs that you shouldn't get as your first job in your legal career. You know, it's something you do when you're in your 40s and have been more grounded, not when you're a novice attorney trying to figure his way around the world. So I said, I have to take this interview. And I did, and John offered me the job. He was willing to wait the next few months until I was finished with my clerkship. So I worked for John Burns for about 3 months. And then John decided to resign as Attorney General and went on to work for an interim Attorney General, and then Michael Garrity, the next Attorney General. And all of a sudden, that 1 year was slowly churning into six. And after about 4 years, I told Lindsay, you know, we've been living here for a while and we've been paying a lot for rent. Maybe it's time to buy a house. And I think it was at that moment that Lindsay and I turned to each other and said, you know, all those plans, those short-term thoughts that this is going to be a one-year project or that next year will be the year that we're going to get out, that we'd really built a home here and that Anchorage was home. This is where we were going to return to. This is a place we fell in love with. And part of that reason was because Alaska, as Maura had said earlier, is a place that has opportunities unlike any other place that I've ever lived. I'm an attorney. I work for a giant law firm that has offices in New York and Washington, D.C. and Anchorage, Alaska. But I also do improv on my free time. It's not something that many of my friends in New York or Washington, D.C. would ever be able to do because they would still be in their office working right now, New York time. Just 4 hours later, believe me. Mothers, don't let your children become lawyers. It's a terrible, terrible, terrible profession. They should be doctors. They get Fridays off, believe me. But Alaska also has embraced me. I've found great friends here and great opportunities. I got to join a great organization like Alaska Common Ground, where I get to talk about issues that are important to me and to be involved with people who deeply and passionately care about this state and this city. And I do believe that we as Alaskans can take this downturn in our economy as an opportunity to look forward. One of those key words that kind of attracted me in the first place was when Morgan and I were doing the interview, she said, John, you're a real trailblazer. And that's what Alaska needs, and Alaska needs trailblazers. It needs people who can think outside the box, people who can see opportunities where opportunities don't exist. And so I blazed my own trail. I'd done that my entire life, so it wasn't something that I was really afraid of. And I wanted to go down that path. Well, now I know that we, all of us in this room and whoever else may hear this story, we have the opportunity to be trailblazers again, to pave our own path, and to ensure that what brought us all up here for 1 year or 6 years or three generations continues to be the thing that attracts people to this state in the future. Thank you.
Our next storyteller is, he holds a certain championship belt on this stage where, you know, a lot of the stories that we're hearing today and a lot of the stories we heard at rehearsal were about, like, knowing things about Alaska before someone else knew them about Alaska, and nobody said it outright about who's, you know, we don't use the words oldest and youngest in this group, but our next storyteller is the most successful at being alive, and he has the most experience at it. And the way he brought it up and sort of rubbed it in everyone else's faces, really sweetly, because of his age, he's sweet about everything. He told us a story about this time when he was in Juneau and he was an attorney. You know, he was already an adult, and he was an attorney, and he was at the bar convention, and other families will, like, host the young attorneys at their house for meals, and he went over and had dinner with Cliff, actually, when Cliff was 7 years old. Take that, Cliff. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the stage Jim Wanamaker.
I'm easily the most chronologically advantaged person on the stage tonight. And My assignment that Cliff gave me, which I have chosen to accept, was to talk about the earliest days after statehood. And how did I end up in Alaska? I had a classmate in law school at the University of Washington, Bob Irwin. And when we finished the and graduated from the University of Washington and passed the bar in Washington, he said, "Jim, why don't you drive with me up to Alaska?" He was a resident of Seward, and he was going home. And 2 days later, we started out. I said, "Sure, I'll do it." And 2 days later, we started out. We were in Anchorage in 3.5 days because he had a girlfriend in the Miss Alaska contest, and we had to get there in time for that. I got a good look around. I spent a week in Seward, looked around, and went to Fairbanks and looked at Anchorage. And on my way out, I stopped in Juneau, and I loved what I saw. I loved the state. I'm a country boy at heart. I grew up in a rural setting, and that appealed to me. And I loved the people I met, so I wanted to come back. I had to do a tour of Army duty, a short tour, as was available at that time. And so I applied to the Attorney General's office, and I was interviewed by Ralph Moody in Seattle, and hired. And on July 5th, 1960, I landed in the Juneau Airport as a new hiree, new Assistant Attorney General for the state. And I was met by then Deputy Attorney General Gary Thurlow and John Havelock, who many of you know. And I knew I hadn't landed in a place where the streets were lined with gold, because Gary was driving this old rusted out four-door Chevrolet, which was really a two-door because the two back doors were rusted shut. We went then to the hotel. I couldn't afford to stay at the Baranoff. I stayed at the Alaska Hotel, an old wooden structure. I was on the second story, or kind of a 2.5 story high. And I went in my room and got another reminder that the streets were not lined with gold, because there was a steel eyelet in the floor, middle of the floor, and a coil of rope around it. And I was intrigued by that. So when I went out, I asked the clerk, "What is that?" And he said, "That's a fire escape." He said, "If there's a fire, you just open the window, throw that out, and climb down the rope." So I knew that you know, this is Alaska was not overly prosperous at that time. Next day, I reported to the Attorney General's office, met with Ralph Moody, the Attorney General, and Gary Thurlow, the deputy, and got my assignments. I was assigned to be the attorney for the Department of Natural Resources, for the Department of Education, and Department of Revenue. And this I was a 25-year-old kid just out of law school, and to have these major assignments was putting me over the moon. On the next week, I was said, "Come on, we're going to go down and talk to Bill Egan." That was the governor, Bill Egan, and about legislation. And I walked out with assignments to modify the Uniform Commercial Code for Alaska enactment, to work on the Water Appropriation Act, and to come up with a funding formula for the schools, all of which I did in that ensuing year, and worked with the governor, the attorney general. Wonderful stuff for a kid just out of law school. I wanted to come up to Anchorage eventually, so I asked for a transfer up to the Attorney General's office in Anchorage, to the District Attorney's office, more likely. And I spent, I was to report for work on Wednesday, but I went in on Tuesday and just introduced myself and met everybody. And the then District Attorney, Jim Merbs, he said, "By the way, here's your file for the trial tomorrow." There was that wonderful can-do spirit. And from what I heard on the stage today, that problem-solving can-do spirit is still alive today. Thanks for the chance to talk.
Thank you, Jim. Our next storyteller is someone who's obsessed with barnacles. So if you want to know more about that, you feel free to buy her a root beer. She's a big fan of the root beer here. Without further ado, our storyteller, Rachel Mills.
A little short, so it's hard. Okay, sorry. So I'm a botanist, and my specialty is the evolution of invasive plant species, plant taxonomy, and the identification of native plant species. I don't know what's in your garden. Native only, okay? And I have studied plants everywhere from different environments, from tall grass prairies in Minnesota to the dry rainforests of Australia. I've been all over looking at plants, and I have a small secret, and that is I'm afraid to fly. I'm terrified of flying. Petrified, it's been diagnosed, I swear. So it's really bad. I was diagnosed with a fear of flying. It came on as a child, and they said it was a happy combination of claustrophobia, right, great one, and a fear of death. And yes, I know, we're all afraid to die. I get it, we're all afraid, but I'm more afraid than you, okay? That's how it works. So I went to the child therapist and they said, yeah, you've got a fear of death. I had this existential crisis at the age of 5 and it was a real problem. And I actually was so afraid of this topic that I was removed from Catholic school's discussion of death and dying in religious class, and that was to avoid a panic attack. I was 12, so that was very important. Okay, so here I am, terrified of flying, and of course I have to get in all these planes. Now, I'm very proud of myself. I've never grounded a plane. I feel like that is a milestone. I've never had one grounded. Thank you. Never had one grounded. But I have, of course, been walked up and down the aisles by the stewards because they need to calm me down and pretty much shut me up from freaking everybody else out, right, because it scares everyone. So I've been walked up and down. I've been put in the back. I've been calmed down. I've been given drugs, whatever. And so things happen. So finally, as an adult, I decided I cannot let this rule my life. I can't be ruled by a fear. So I went to hypnotherapy, and I went through a year of hypnosis, and I did not conquer my fear of flying, but I know how to manage my fear, which is really good because it helps out with flying these days. So you might be asking yourself, what the heck is a botanist doing that's afraid of flying, and she lives in Alaska? Well, like many of you guys, I moved here for a job. Because although you think of botany as a very sexy science, I mean, it is really the sexiest of the ologies, as we all know. And after The Martian, I'm sure you all think that there's jobs everywhere, but pretty much there isn't unless a botanist dies. Again, I'm afraid of dying, so that doesn't help. So anyway, unless a botanist dies, really, there's no jobs. So I got this dream call in 2013. I finally had this call that I was going to get a job here in Alaska, and it was going to start up. And I couldn't believe it. This was finally going to happen. Somebody's going to employ me to actually look at plants. And I couldn't believe my dreams came true. Okay. So what I've been doing, I should go back with the hypnotherapy for a moment. So what I've been doing to get myself on planes is I have a little trick. And when I get on planes now, I still cry, and it's still kind of disturbing. So what I do to the unfortunate person who gets seated next to me, because they are unfortunate, is I have a little trick for what I do with them. I say, hi, my name's Rachel. I'm a fearful flyer. I have a deal for you. I will give you $20 to talk me through takeoff and landing. Okay, what do you think? Or, I'll pay you $100 to hit me in the face so hard you knock me out and I sleep through the flight. Now, nobody has taken the $100. I would pay anyone. So if you ever sit next to me, I will pay you. Nobody's taking me up. Usually everyone laughs. They ignore the tears. They talk me through the takeoff and landing, and we get through it. My favorite flight actually was when I got food poisoning on Qantas. Thank you, Qantas. You cannot be afraid of flying when you're vomiting all day in the plane. So thank you very much, Qantas. So here I am, I'm leaving my small island in Texas. I'm gonna go off to the last frontier to be a botanist. And, unfortunately I was conscious for the whole flight because of course my seatmate would not hit me. It was a shame, but he did. We had a bumpy landing coming into Anchorage. And bless his heart, he did hold my hand through the whole thing free of charge. It was free. Thank that man. I loved him. So here I am. I'm coming to Alaska, and I'm going to start as a botanist. My parents live here. It's going to be great. I'm so excited. Botany, yeah. So I get to my job. It's with this native corporation. We're going to do wetland delineation. So we're going to go out and identify plants and be wetland delineators. It's just the best thing ever. And I get to the first meeting, and they're like, hey, so yeah, Rachel, we need you to look up helicopter prices and rotor time. And I'm like, oh, for somebody else's field work? And they're like, no, that's what wetland delineators do. We get dropped off in remote locations with a helicopter. And I'm like, oh, that's great. They said, by the way, we also need to look up the crash statistics for people that die in helicopter crashes. Fear of death, right? Fear of death, really good idea. So I'm like, oh God, are you serious? So I knew a lot for a short period of time about how many people have survived and died in helicopters versus planes. Helicopter's not so good. When you hit the ground, it's really not that good. Okay, so here I am. But I was lucky enough to get to do 2 years of field work. I flew all over the state, everywhere from Wasilla all the way to Barrow. I have been dropped off in remote locations where probably nobody else has stepped foot ever in their lives. I've seen bears, I've seen moose, I've seen caribou. One time we landed our helicopter in a blueberry patch that was so incredible, we all stopped work immediately and just started gathering blueberries. It was incredible. And what I also found was, helicopters aren't that scary. They're actually really smooth. I don't know if anyone's ever flown in a helicopter, but they have a really smooth ride, except for the first time. When you take off in a helicopter, it comes off the ground, and that's great. But when it starts to go forward, the nose dips real far down. And it's like, hey, pilot, you're going down. And he's like, no, we're fine, it's fine. And you get over that. But I feel like that should be part of the safety speech. Here's the beacon that they'll find us when the helicopter crashes, and here's your seatbelt, and oh, don't worry, it's gonna look like we're hitting the ground, but we're not, it's okay, it's a helicopter, it's how it works. So I got used to flying in helicopters, and it actually became so pedestrian that after a while, my daily work commute, I'd be reading the newspaper, hanging in the helicopter, and just be like, oh yeah, there's a bear, yeah. Where's the plants? You know, I wanna do some botanizing. So, I mean, it was wonderful. It's an incredible experience. And also while I was working for this company, I was told, hey, we need you to go to Wainwright. And I said, okay, sure, Wainwright. And they're like, yeah, but this one, you know, you're not in a helicopter. I said, okay, great, no helicopter. This is excellent, I can do this. So we get to Barrow, and I don't know if anyone's flown to any of the remote villages, but we get to Barrow, and we go to get on the plane to go to Wainwright, which was a very small plane, very small. And so I thought, okay, they said, who wants to ride with the pilot? You know, like up front with the pilot. And I said, oh, I want to do that. I'm afraid of flying, so I want to ride with the pilot. So I'm flying along, and it actually wasn't so bad. I'm thinking, ah, it's kind of like a helicopter. All right, field work, I can do this. Yeah, hypnotherapy. So I'm doing great. And then I look over at the pilot, who is asleep. I swear to you all, asleep. So I'm sitting there, and I'm like, ha, 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 wake up. And nobody else seemed to notice the pilot is asleep. And I'm like, fear of flying, fear of death, claustrophobia, really bad, wake up. So we landed, thank God. We did our field work, all went well. And on the flight back, he fell asleep again. I'm not telling you what airline it was, but he fell asleep. But I had a wonderful experience. It was incredible for 2 years going out to Alaska. It was just a wonderful opportunity because, honestly, there really aren't that many jobs for me as a person who identifies plants. It's really, there's not that much out there. But unfortunately, in September 2015, as many of you know, I was sitting in the living room with my husband, and it was so odd because my husband does not pay attention to, like, the news the way that I do. And he gets this phone out for some reason, and he says, oh, that's interesting. Shell's pulling out of the Arctic. And I went, oh, that's a real problem. Because my company works with oil and gas, and it's in the North Slope, so it's really affected by this. And so I was like, wow, that's kind of a big deal. So we get into work the next day, and it's just this horrible depression that's descended upon everyone. And we all went, oh, what's gonna happen? And the president of the company actually came down to every floor of our building and pretty much said, I wish that this wasn't going to affect us, but Shell is one of our major clients, and if you know of any other job opportunity that you've been offered, you should take it, is what he said. And it was that cut and dry. I mean, it was serious. So we all knew how dire the situation was, and we were strongly affected, and there were layoffs that started in November, and then in January, on a Tuesday, I don't know why, that was my day to get laid off, was on Tuesday, and I had made it through two rounds, but I was laid off from my company, and they said it had nothing to do with me, of course, and there was no hard feelings. Actually, there was so much laughter that one of my coworkers didn't realize I'd been fired. So that was nice, I liked that. But it was a real shock. But the other problem was the next day after that, the state's hiring freeze went into effect. So I had a bit of a hard time looking for jobs. But what I found is I've found jobs. I've landed on my feet. I haven't found a job as a botanist, but I have continued to find work. And like my fear of flying, you know, I'm not going to let this rule me, and I'm not going to stop just because I, you know, had to be laid off and because right now the state's economy is what it is. I think that we are going to continue and we're going to improve. And like my fear of flying, I think it will get better. And I feel like I'll be botanizing sooner than you know. That's it.
Our next storyteller is a self-proclaimed graduate of the Million Man March. He wishes to protect the vulnerable from oppression locally, nationally, and globally. Of course, this is impossible. Oh, no. Which means that it's a perfect aspiration for a 21st century man. So please welcome our next storyteller, Kokai.
Struggling stars, cha-cha him the father. Just look within yourself and see them treasures laid there. We gon' polish up, just shine, see them heavens from afar, yo. If you catch a fire, then your fire will ever burn over hills and valleys. I'm in Waterland journey, persecuted by society. Them down praise me, them no want to hear me talking, say I don't know reality. But the scars upon me body, yo, that reality. Show them off to the world, how them brutalize me. Them no want to hear me. Oh, my goodness. I'm like kind of overcome by emotion, which is why that intro failed. The reason why I'm overcome by emotion is because I'm one of those rare things, an Alaskan who actually admits that he was born and raised here. Embedded in me is this thing called the owner state mentality. So when I was 17 years old, I read this book called The Autobiography of Minister Malcolm X, and that became the left side of my brain. I then listened to a tape, cassette tape, because this is in the 90s, and it was Legend by Bob Marley, and that became the right side of my brain. And I learned about poor boys who were able to change world history. And I started to dream from Anchorage, Alaska, because I was born in this place called Fairview in the 80s, that I, as a poor boy, could also change history. Fast forward to 2010. I am working at Food Bank of Alaska, and I learn about a bill that is going on in the Senate by Bill Willikowski. He had put it in 2009, and it was called the School Meals Bill. What this bill did was ask the state legislature to give $1.9 million to address what the federal government reimbursed and what the parents of children could pay. So there was a gap of $1.9 million. In 2009, the state legislature was spending like $3 billion, $3.2 billion. So $1.9 million, $2 million didn't seem like a whole lot of money. So it didn't make any sense to me at Food Bank of Alaska as to why this bill, which seemed to be a win-win, wasn't moving forward. And I learned about this gentleman by the name of Representative Bill Stoltz. He was the chair of the House Finance Committee, and by simply choosing not to hear a bill, He could make it dead. He did this in 2009. He did this in 2010. In 2010, I learned about something called the United Nations Millennial Goals, and that the United States of America had decided that it would address child hunger and end it by 2015. And I said to myself, you could do something about that, especially with the resources that you have access to with Food Bank of Alaska, meaning Relationship Web, because I still didn't have any money. So I did the practical things that you do if you happen to be in the 21st century. I started a blog. I changed over my Facebook page. I started talking about child hunger and putting out facts and doing videos. And Bill Stoltz didn't do a thing. In 2011, Bill Witkowski put forth a second school meals bill. And this time, because I had gained the trust of Brendan Joe Kelly at the Anchorage Press, I decided to do a letter campaign. So I did a posting inside the Anchorage Press. I did a letter campaign. And Mr. Bill Stoltz did not say a word. Silence. So I started thinking, what can we do in order to actually get his attention? And what came to mind was a 1960s tactic, a hunger strike. Now, if you have never had to speak to your parents about a decision that you had made politically to go on a hunger strike, you will not know how intense said conversation can be. I remember being in my dining room with my mother and my father, and my mother looking at me like I was absolutely crazy. So what you're trying to tell me, baby, is that you're going to commit suicide. Because these politicians are not going to listen to you because you don't have any money and you don't have any votes. I laid out my plan. I was going to give this guy until Bob Marley's birthday, and she's looking at me like that doesn't mean anything to him. So in order to get my mother to go along with this, because my father wasn't looking like he was going to say anything different than what my mother was going to say, I agreed that I would consume 100 calories a day while I was on a hunger strike to advance this bill of school meals for the children of Alaska. I do a press conference in January, and there is, again, silence from Mr. Stoltz. February 6th happens. I fly to Juneau. I get picked up by an activist by the name of Christina Muntz. She takes me to a house on 7th and G. I say, that's a sign, because Bob Marley's sung all his songs in the key of G. Food Bank of Alaska is there. They tell me, please, because you're so controversial, Kakai, with what you're doing, we're going to be here for a week. Please don't do any lobbying. And I go, okay. Mind you, I'm not eating. I am 260 pounds at the beginning of this hunger strike. In a week, because I'm really like muscle, and so I was just, you know, like 20 pounds bigger than what I am right now, I lose 10 pounds. I show up in Bill Witkowski's office. He says, yo, you've been here for a week. I say, yes, I know. Why didn't you say anything? Because I was trying to be nice. How much weight did you lose? 10 pounds. You lost 10 pounds. Don't do that. Say something. So in week two, I end up talking to the Anchorage Daily News, because it was the Anchorage Daily News, not the Alaska Dispatch at the time. It was Anchorage Daily News. And I get a story. And then I contact my friends over Facebook, and we start doing protests. We do a protest in Fairbanks. We do a protest in Anchorage. We do a protest in Juneau. Guess what the response was from Bill Stoltz? Exactly. Silence. Don't know about you, but if you happen to go on a hunger strike, you actually want to hear something from the person that you're targeting because you're losing weight. 10 pounds a week. At the beginning of the third week, this thing called confidence left me. I got a little worried about what the outcome of this thing would be, because I had already done everything that Saul Alinsky is said to do in his books, and they had not worked. We do another round of protest in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau. I go on the radio. I sit in his committee, ice grilling him. I have Sikhs, you know, people from like India, in white, in lotus position, four deep, meditating in front of the camera. Week three, 30 pounds lost. How much communication from Mr. Stoltz's office? Zero. I am now lashing out at people on social media. Why? This does not appear to be working. My friend Christina comes up with an idea. She says, how about instead of Mr. Stoltz, we go after his aides? At this particular time, Mr. Stoltz decides to do a news article. This is the second news article about what has now become known as the Juneau Hunger Strike, because people have been calling in, and now it's been named the Juneau Hunger Strike. He says that because this is the wrong way to go about doing legislation, he isn't going to hear this bill at all. That's not the news you want to hear at the beginning of week four. Christina's plan to go after the aides is the only game in town. So what they do is begin, my friends, my activist friends in Juneau who hear about this and come on board, they begin going after the aides of Mr. Stoltz. That means after work, they follow them to the bar. They draft a statement of saying, do you know what's going on with the Juneau hunger strike? And after the bar lets out at 2 o'clock in the morning, 2:30 in the morning, my faithful friends are passing out this flyer. Come Friday, after I've lost 40 pounds, right? The aide comes out half drunk and says, look, this is hurting my boss. What do you want? And my friends say, we would like an audience with your boss to talk about this bill. My friends secure an audience with Bill Stoltz, who is absolutely flabbergasted when they show up, that he's having a conversation with him. I have another friend by the name of Nick Moe help introduce legislation to come in from the outside. So instead of 1.9 million, we end up getting 3 million set aside to schools that will go into the school nutrition program as well as help school gardens. At which point I say, that's good enough for me. Let's close this out. At day 28, when I had lost 43 pounds. So, the moral of this story happens to be, in Anchorage, Alaska, like a sister has said beforehand, you can do anything. You just may have to put your life on the line, lose 43 pounds, but you too can be a poor boy from Fairview and make history.
Thank you for tuning in to Addressing Alaskans Today. We've been listening to an event hosted by Alaska Common Ground titled Common Sense, Stories of Alaska's Changing Economy. This show was recorded on September 29th at the 49th State Brewing Company. We were only able to feature a portion of the stories shared that night. In order to hear the rest of them, you can visit alaskapublic.org.
Addressing Alaskans is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Theme music is by Patrick Lee. The views expressed are those of the hosts and participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to our website at alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Learn more about Addressing Alaskans and listen online at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.